This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscow-Aim. Our guest Kenneth Miller's bio says that he owns a house near Barnegat Bay in New Jersey where he can watch the, quote, inexorable rise in sea level. He's a distinguished professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Rutgers University, part of a team of researchers who've been tracking sea level rise over the centuries. Their recent findings have important implications for New Jersey. We asked Kenneth Miller to join us on Radio Times, and nice to have you with us on the show.
It's great to be with you, Marty.
So how much sea rise in Barnegat Bay have you observed?
Well, we've observed in the past century, from 1911 to 2011, about 16 to 18 inches of rise in that general area from Barnegat Bay down through Cape May.
That's a lot of sea level rise.
Well, that's the past sea level rise. Going forward, the rate of rise is actually going to increase. And so we provide, along with our colleagues, we provided a new assessment of sea level rise in the Mid-Atlantic region, focusing on New Jersey and using the recent geological history, the rate of ocean warming and melting of ice, and other processes. We estimate that communities can expect about 1.5 feet of sea level rise by 2050 and about 3.5 feet by 2100.
Let me break that down, and let me ask you some basic questions. How do you literally measure sea level rise?
Sea levels are measured with basically taking some kind of reference frame to the ocean and dating it, providing a time series. Now, with the tide gauge data, people measure the tide gauges almost continuously and then average that over, let's say, a period of time of a month to a year. We can measure most precisely with satellites. The satellite data only goes back to about 1993. But geologically, this is a geological team also, we can go back into the past. So our record looks at the whole change in sea level over the past 10,000 years in New Jersey. And we can say what the rates of rise have been. And it allows us to actually isolate the natural geological processes that are causing sea level rise and those that are caused by humans.
Well, let's go back a couple of thousand years. Do you see a period of no sea level rise, and then do you see the beginnings of sea level rise when you look back in time?
Well, if we go back to about 20,000 years ago, sea level was almost 400 feet below present, and it rose fairly rapidly from about 15,000 to about 10,000. And then over the past 10,000 years, it has been rising globally much slower. What we're able to show is that in New Jersey, particularly over the past 4,000 years, that the rate of rise that we have seen in the 20th century and continuing today is unprecedented. And so if we go back, there's two effects here. One is the global change in sea level due to warming oceans and melting ice sheets. But New Jersey is also subsiding or sinking, and that's due to natural geological processes. And they do vary in the region. It is greater along the coastline from Sandy Hook to Atlantic City to Cape May than it is, let's say, at the Battery in New York or Philadelphia or Baltimore. And so the fact that it's sinking adds to this rise in sea level.
Well, and again, let me break that apart as well. So why is New Jersey, or certainly parts of New Jersey, why is it sinking? What is it about, I guess, the geology of the state that makes it vulnerable to sinking?
Well, the whole region is subsiding from Long Island all the way down south into the Carolinas. And you can think of that as a giant seesaw, because 20,000 years ago, there was a big ice sheet in Canada, which pushed the crust of the earth down. And as that melted, the earth's crust bounced up. Well, if that's bouncing up like a seesaw, if it's going up like a seesaw, something else has to go down. So we are sinking due in part to this regional effect, which gives us about a third of the rise in sea level that we see. Mm. Places like Atlantic City, Cape May, Lewis, Delaware, and Sandy Hook are subsiding a little bit more. And one of the reasons why is, as you know, that those regions are in areas of the coastal plain that have a lot of sand and mud, which can compress. Just think about if you had a bucket of wet sand. It compresses, okay? The difference is that New York and Philadelphia and Baltimore, these are on basically hard rocks, right. So they don't compress. So that's why the shoreline itself is seeing additional sinking compared to New York, Baltimore, or Washington.
And I noticed looking at this most recent study, the groundwater withdrawal is also an explanation. Is that what, drinking water, people using drinking water?
Absolutely. So if you have that bucket of sandy water, okay, and you start pulling water out of it and taking it out of the bucket, okay, the sand's going to sink even further. And so Atlantic City gets its water supply, for example, out of a unit that they call the 800-foot sand, which is at about 800 feet at Atlantic City. Mm-hmm. But that whole Atlantic County area is pulling 20 million gallons out per day, and that has contributed to the sinking in that region.
I'm trying to imagine, I mean, what you're predicting is sea level rise of 1.5 feet in by the year 2050. So that's within 40 years. If that were to turn out to be true, what would New Jersey look like?
Well, again, that's about, you know, 18 inches, about what Atlantic City saw in the 100-year period mm-hmm. between 1911 and 2011. So what you see, we'll see, is continued beach erosion, continued need to nourish the beaches, continued need to protect certain areas that are particularly vulnerable. I'm much more concerned that as you look forward to 2100 with over 3 feet of rise, the barrier islands become almost very difficult to defend at that point with 3.5 feet. We can say with some degree of certainty, by the way, that this isn't just a wild guess. We can say just using the modern rates, if they didn't even increase, okay, by 2050, you will at least get 10 inches of rise.
Mm.
So, 10 inches, that's basically almost a foot is enough to turn a storm surge from an ordinary average northeaster into what we would call a 10 or even a 100-year storm surge.
Let me reintroduce you, and that's Kenneth Miller. He's a distinguished professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Rutgers University, part of a team of researchers that have been tracking sea level rise and looking specifically at New Jersey. If you have any questions or comments, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Even as you look up and down the East Coast or maybe even around the world, is there something about New Jersey that makes it even more vulnerable to sea level rise?
Well, again, it's the fact that it is sinking both regionally and locally. Norfolk area is sinking even slightly more than New Jersey, and New Orleans is sinking almost twice as fast as New Jersey.
Right.
And so New Orleans and Bangladesh are regions where globally this subsidence effect or sinking effect is naturally the greatest. So New Jersey's not in the worst position, but we are relatively threatened compared to other regions.
But if we're talking about warming temperatures and the melting of the ice sheet, is there something that can be done proactively to reduce sea level rise?
Well, it obviously, going forward, well, we've used in our projections the various emission scenarios for carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, from the typical business as usual track that we are on now to low end scenarios. So the low end scenarios for, let's say, 2100 for global could, if we reduce emissions, mm-hmm. could be as low as just 10 inches or 12 inches, basically a foot by 2100. But still, no matter what we do, we're still looking at locally still getting this substance effect of about 9 inches. And plus, there's one other effect. I think most people know that there's this Gulf Stream offshore of New Jersey. And as that changes in its intensity, if it gets weaker, sea level actually rises in this area by several inches, maybe 8 inches. So that's another effect that has to be taken into account. So it kind of adds on to our jeopardy, because we have the global effects due to warming and melting ice. We have the regional effects due to this seesaw. We have the local effects due to the sediments sinking because of withdrawing groundwater, but we also have this oceanographic effect.
Is it possible to build dune systems or levees or, you know, some kind of architecture to protect the New Jersey shoreline?
When you build a sea, well, obviously New Jersey has been a poster child for attempting to do this for many years. The Walt Sea Break was put in the early 20th century, I believe, to protect the train there. Of course, the Walt Sea Break actually makes the erosion in front of the wall worse and makes it more difficult to maintain a beach. The main ways to fight back, as we saw in Hurricane Sandy, those towns that had good dune systems, either natural or human-made, fared much better than those who had not done beach nourishment, with Long Beach Island being the poster child. The southern end of Long Beach Island had refused beach nourishment. Mayor Mancini of Beach Haven reported massive destruction of that part of the island. The northern part of the island, the Lovelace and Harvey Cedars, was nourished in 2010 and had a very good dune, and that dune protected those homes in the northern part of the island. So we can fight back. We will fight back with beach nourishment. There are areas that can be what we call hard stabilized, that is to put seawalls or breakwaters. Good example of that in Sandy was the Asbury Park Convention Center was well protected by its breakwater. So we can fight back, but it is costly.
Has Sandy been a wake-up call for this issue?
I think it has, because we can say in one of the statements in our paper is that the rise in sea level that we saw just due to the warming effects in the 20th century exposed something like 35,000 New Jerseyans and 40-some thousand New Yorkers to flooding that wouldn't have been exposed to flooding if it hadn't been for the sea level rise.
Interesting. What about planned retreat? People are, you know, every now and then you hear someone saying, you know, we just must retreat from the coastline. I don't know how doable that is. Is that something that you think about?
I do. We can't retreat from New York City. We can't retreat from Queens. We can't retreat from Long Branch. I mean, these are high-value structures. There are many areas of the shoreline along the East Coast, though, where we probably do need to retreat. And one of those that comes to mind is Highway 12, which links Outer Banks of Carolina to the mainland, and that road has basically become untenable. There are areas in New Jersey where we have fought back and nourished the beaches where we shouldn't have, because they're in threatened areas near inlets and others. So one has to take the geology of the region. I used to teach a course called Should I Sell My Shore House? And it was because people would call me and ask, you know, I have a house here, should I sell it? Well, where is it exactly? So where your house is going to depend on how threatened it is.
Well, Kenneth Miller, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times, getting us up to speed on this important issue.
Marty, it was a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
You're very welcome. A distinguished professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Rutgers University. Shifting gears after this very short break, we'll be talking about CES. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Chapin School, a pre-K through 8th grade independent school in Princeton, supports WHYY. With small classes and high academic expectations, Chapin students are given individual attention from a faculty dedicated to helping them succeed. A character development program founded on respect, responsibility, honesty, kindness, and perseverance is woven into day-to-day school life. January open houses are this Sunday, the 12th at 2 p.m. and Tuesday, the 28th at 9 a.m. More at chapinschool.org.
It's one of the brightest berry bearers you can grow. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll tell you how to get the best show from your Pyracantha, a.k.a. Firethorn, plus answers to an especially large selection of your growing questions. It's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, Philomena is a hit film, but the real-life woman who had a child taken away for adoption can't forget the last image of him over 50 years ago.
All I could see was a little face at the back of the window looking out, and I'm looking down the window thinking, oh my God, he's gone.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The Consumer Electronics Show is underway in Las Vegas, the annual trade show where companies tout the latest in high-tech gadgets. This year, it looks like huge, super high-def TVs and wearable technology are some of the hot new products. We asked Joanna Stern to join us. She's personal technology columnist for the Wall Street Journal. And Joanna Stern, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here.
And later we'll be joined by Mark Purton. He's executive editor of Engadget. If you want to join our conversation, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coaim. Joanna, for people that have never been to CES, and most people haven't, can you describe it to our listeners?
Sure. It's like, you know, the best way to describe it is probably all the best guys in America put together in a couple of show floors, and then also kind of spread around all of Vegas. So pretty much everywhere you look, you're seeing computers or televisions, and now this year a lot of people wearing technology. So it's really just this influx of a lot of gadgets and wires and electronics.
And do you personally get some sensory overload as you walk the aisles?
I definitely do. I mean, I've been doing this now for about 6 years, or this might be my seventh CES. So you know, every time I walk in, I'm like, oh, I remember what this feels like. but definitely this year, you know, the idea that you're wearing these electronics, that's where I'm feeling a lot of sensory overload. The idea that you're wearing glasses that project images in front of you, I mean, that's definitely a lot to take in. I've definitely felt a couple of times as I've been shooting video or talking to people with these glasses on, like, I can't talk to you. I'm looking right now, you know, in a way, into the future.
Well, and we actually did a show about Google glasses, and I just can't imagine both wanting them and also wearing them and being able to sort of navigate between these visuals and then, of course, the rest of the world.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's one thing Google is doing a really good job of balancing. They're really taking that into account. Here at the show, we're seeing sort of the extreme idea of sort of really virtual reality headsets, being able to put on basically a TV in front of your face, a real projected screen. So what they're showing here is doesn't feel like we're all going to be wearing these, but it's definitely a different idea of how do we look at a screen in our life. I mean, our lives are so much now about the screens we have, the one in our pocket, the one at our desk, the one in our living room. So more and more people thinking, or more and more companies thinking, like, well, how can we put this even more in front of your face?
Would it be fair to say that screens are the sort of message that's coming out of CES?
You know, I would say so. I would say that's definitely half of the message, right? Always there's this big talk about TV, and literally big, right? How big can TVs get? Every year it's like, who can make a bigger TV? Can you make a 250-inch TV? And, you know, can you have the best type of technology in it? And really, when you look at these TVs, they're magnificent. You sort of look at them and you're like, I can't believe how far we've come in terms of the visuals and the content that we can view. But beyond the screens, right, what we're seeing a move to putting technology in the objects around us. And to me, that's the most interesting part of the show. Every year there are TVs. Every year there are new laptops. Every year there are new phones. And even, you know, the idea that we're putting screens at our wrists now. But to me, the idea that we're putting technology in the objects around us, and that is a really big theme, this sort of Internet of Things, as people are calling them. So can we put the Internet in different parts of our home? Can we put them in our light bulbs? Can we put them in our light switches? Can we put them in our coffee pot? Can we put them in a toothbrush? And these are all legitimate objects that were debuted at the show or showed at the show. And to me, the big question is, how is this stuff going to help us?
Well, that's a good question. Why would we want, I have a very nice electric toothbrush, but why would I want the Internet in my toothbrush?
It's a good question, and to me, it's actually one of the more fun things that I've seen at the show, because it talks to your phone, right? And so it can tell you on your phone, it can track your patterns of your brushing.
Really?
And I personally, I'm happy to admit to all of the listeners that I don't brush my teeth for long enough, and there are some toothbrushes out there that, you know, will buzz and tell you, you know, you should keep brushing your teeth, or after 2 minutes, it will kind of tell you you're done. But in this way, you're sort of can track how long you brushed your teeth every day, if you brush them in the right areas. And for those that do have a little bit of a brushing problem, they might be willing to give it a try. I certainly am. I mean, it definitely sounds wacky that my toothbrush is talking to my phone, but I mean, if it can help me, I'm willing to test it. And that's where I think it's going to be an interesting next year and the next couple of years is testing all of these things. I mean, do they make our life better?
Well, it's an interesting question. And Joanna, you had a piece recently about using, I guess, a smart fork or a fork that, mm-hmm. that monitored your eating habits. You actually sounds like you learned a few things about how you eat your lunch or dinner.
I definitely did. And this is a perfect another example of this kind of wacky gadget that this debuted at last year's CES. And I was sort of like blown away by it, and I ended up talking about it a lot because it got a lot of attention.
Yeah.
And then it came out, and Brookstone was marketing this fork, which vibrates when you eat too fast, that in saying that you can lose weight if you don't eat too fast. And I spoke to some dietitians, and they said that's true, right? But a lot of other things to consider, right? You can't just eat too, you know, eat slow. You can't eat a huge plate of pasta slower and expect to lose weight.
Right.
And so I ended up really testing this thing and finding that, you know, the fork didn't work very well. It had a lot of bugs. It didn't always pick up the food or the bites I was taking on the fork. But I did find that I do eat too fast and that I really should keep better track of what I'm eating. And the fork wasn't smart enough to know what I was eating, but I found that it did teach me something. So I was hoping that, you know, I paid the $99 for the fork and now people can learn and maybe they right. start tracking what they eat, maybe not buying a fork that talks to their phone.
And this does seem to be a part of this trend that I don't know even what to call it, biometric tools, fitness, personal technology. And the idea is that you can wear things that will tell you about your heart rate, the number of steps you've taken, blah, blah, blah.
Exactly. That is another sweeping trend here at the show, wearable technology. And we've mentioned screens. The idea that we might have more screens on our body, I mean, we're really where people want to place tech on our body, and the form and the function are really related. And I wrote a piece about this in the journal yesterday about how these things are related. So you're probably only going to see a screen on your wrist or in front of your eyes. And then you might find that more and more companies are coming out with sensors to put on your body. So those might be in your shoes or in your socks, or they might be in a belt. They might even be in different types of bracelets, and they might even be in a bra. So there's kind of different use cases for wearing technology. And I think, you know, back to your question, this idea of fitness, a lot of people are trying to see about this idea of quantitative self. How can we find out more about our body by wearing sensors and then fixing some of our patterns? And people are doing some really interesting things there. One company called Lumoback has come up with a belt that has a sensor in it.
Huh.
And if you slouch, the belt will vibrate. So basically, it's like a nagging mom with you all the time telling you to sit up straight.
Can hardly wait.
Right, you can hardly wait. And so, you know, that's an interesting use case. Another company called Sensoria is putting sensors in a bra. And that's instead of wearing a heart rate monitor when you're running. They're also putting those sensors in a shoe because that is more, it can tell more accuracy about how you're moving your feet when you're running, can help with the health of the foot, or they claim it can help with the health of the foot, and it can tell you more about your steps. So some things out here are very, very futuristic, though some of them are going to come out this year. The big question is, do people want this information
right.
about their bodies?
And whether they will use it to improve their health and fitness, if that indeed is the goal.
Exactly. And you know, there's a lot of medical uses for some of this technology. When I do write about some of these things, I am always surprised about some of the reaction I do get from readers who say, I really do have back problems, and this really will help me. So, you know, whether some of these things end up just being a niche type of thing, well, remains to be seen.
Well, let me reintroduce you. And I have to say, I'm laughing to myself, but also gritting my teeth, because we're talking about all this new, cool technology. And we have the worst phone line with you, Joanna Stern. But we will muscle on. And she is a personal technology columnist for The Wall Street Journal. She is joining us from the Consumer Electronics Show, which is underway in Las Vegas. And we do this pretty much watch every year or so to check in on some of the newest gadgets, whether we like them or not, whether we'll use them or not. We'd love to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email with any questions or comments. What is our email? RadioTimes@whyy.org. Or you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coane. Joanna, I have to ask you about what is being described as Michael Bay's meltdown. Can you describe what happened to him?
Yeah, he had a little bit of a meltdown on stage. It appears that you've just got to watch his video. It appears he had sort of a meltdown on stage and his teleprompter didn't work, and he just sort of stormed off stage saying he couldn't really talk much more about the curved screens that were being talked about. And you know, it's a little viral fun, certainly for Samsung. I mean, I'm not sure how their executives feel, but definitely got a lot of people talking here at the show.
Well, especially a guy that does all these blockbuster movies is struggling with a teleprompter. I don't know. Seems kind of funny.
Right.
To me.
I mean, you know, I think when you watch it, you wonder, couldn't he have just winged it? but you know, people get it. Yes, definitely ironic.
Talk a bit about these gigantic TVs. You referenced them earlier. I had to even figure out what 4K means, but we're talking about huge, really super high-def, thin, and curved TVs. Describe to us, Joanna, what are we looking at?
Yeah, so last year we sort of saw the emergence of 4K, which is really four times the resolution of HD. So just imagine the HD TV you have in your home being even more crisp, even more vibrant and bright. And what we're seeing here is, again, that push to that. But the big talk about these things is, like, when are these going to go mainstream? Because they're really showing just these massive, beautiful TVs that when I look at them and saying, I can never afford that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's sort of like, how do I look at this thing and say, this looks amazing, but I'm never going to have this? But LG in particular is showing a 107-inch 4K TV. It's amazing. It's bright. But a lot of these companies are showing, LG and Samsung are showing, the idea that they have this flexible display technology where the display can bend now. They're trying to see how they can take advantage of that. Obviously, you don't want to be bending your screen, your TV screen all the time, but LG specifically has a model that will curve the screen in. So if you press a button, and it will go from flat to semi-curved on the side, sort of like if you were to curve a piece of paper around or sorts. And it's a little bit more of an immersive experience. They're saying that these should come out later this year, but again, no idea on the pricing.
Joanna, we're going to call you back and get you on a better phone line. And so why don't you hang up? We'll call you back. And we'll get you back on the air.
All right, I'm sorry.
Not your fault. Not a problem. We will fix it. Joining us now is Mark Purton, and he is executive editor at Engadget, and he is also at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. And Mark Purton, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Nice to have you here. I've been talking with Joanna Stern. She's been getting us up to speed on some of the things that she has been looking at CES. Anything wowed you so far?
Well, there are certainly some things that we're really excited about, and a number of them have made it to the final stage of the Best of CES Awards we are doing this year. And certainly a lot of the buzz this year has been around things like these giant Ultra HD TVs. Samsung and LG and a number of the other companies have been showing them, and you know, they're just amazing in terms of image quality. And in a way, this is the year that Ultra HD is actually starting to come of age. There's more programming available from services like Netflix that have made announcements with the manufacturers. So it's definitely not a mainstream consumer technology yet, but it's pretty exciting to see how much progress it's made in the past year.
And what does it cost to buy one of these gigantic TVs?
Well, that's actually one of the things that I find most exciting, is that even though there are models here that are selling or will be selling in the six-figure range, at least two manufacturers have announced 50-inch sets that are going to sell for about $1,000. So that's a dramatic shift from a year ago or even just a couple of months ago, where these really were luxury products, and a lot of them still are, but they're now down in the range where they're priced at levels consistent with today's current HD sets.
Wow. Well, let me get to Joanna Stern back in on the conversation. Do we have you, Joanna?
I am here. Hopefully, better quality.
Yes, much better quality. And again, she's a personal technology columnist for the Wall Street Journal. I just have one or two questions about these ultra high definition televisions. So, do you see every pore, every imperfection in a person's face, Joanna?
Well, yes, it's a similar thing to when HD came out, right? And everyone was worried about having to put on more makeup. The thing here is that we have to wait for some of the content to get that high resolution. So you're definitely able to see many, many more details. And, you know, interestingly, as you say that, really all the sample content that a lot of people are showing on these TVs are sort of animals. They're sort of like jungle scenes. They're more like galaxy, it looks like space scenes. So I can't really say I've tested that very well, but it's a really good point that they're not showing that kind of content. But yeah, I think it's going to be a similar thing to when HD debuted and people were, again, blown away by how real people looked.
Well, and animals always look nice on TV. Yeah, go ahead, Mark.
No, I was going to say Netflix has been promoting the idea that they'll be having House of Cards in Ultra HD, so we'll see what Kevin Spacey looks like when he's ready for his close-up. So.
Exactly. What about 3D printing, Mark? Can I toss that to you? Is that a big product at CES?
Yeah, 3D printing has been huge this year. They've actually got about 7,000 square feet in the hall set up for 3D printers, and all of the major 3D printing companies have made big announcements. The CEA is predicting that close to 100,000 units are going to be sold this year. Uh-huh. It's obviously still not a consumer technology, but in terms of being accessible to pretty much any kind of business that might depend on something like that for either prototyping or creating new concepts or even just artists and creative people, it's now pretty much in the range of any kind of business or professional that might have a use for it. And it's pretty exciting to see because there's just so many companies involved and so many innovations. And every generation becomes better, smaller, faster, the kind of thing that is more affordable to the business community.
Are you excited about 3D printing, Joanna?
Yep. If I could jump in.
Please.
I think one of the interesting things that we get to see at CES is sort of this future-looking things where things are really expensive, and 3D printing is definitely in that realm. But we're finally starting to see it come down in price a little bit, where I do think by the end of 2014, there will be a $500 3D printer out there. And if we think back to the days of when printing first emerged, I mean, people paid that much for you know, simple black and white laser jet printers. And I think this might be the year we start to see more people put them in their homes. Again, like Mark was saying, not just there yet for consumers, but on the way there with lowering price points.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about the Consumer Electronics Show this year underway in Las Vegas. Joanna Stern, again, personal technology columnist for the Wall Street Journal. Mark Purton is the executive editor at Engadget. We're going to talk more about some of the things that they have been seeing at CES, also taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We've got some emails here at radiotimes@whyy.org. And send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Hankin Apartments introduces Claremont on the Square LEED Rental Residences in Eagleview, Exton, PA. Two-bedroom, two-bath residences with views and amenities. Claremont on the Square is available for tours. HankinApartments.com.
On the next Fresh Air.
Boys, the one and only Mrs. P.L. Travers, the creator of our beloved Mary.
Poppins.
Who else?
Mary Poppins.
Emma Thompson tells us about playing the author of Mary Poppins, P.L. Travers, in the new film Saving Mr. Banks. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
From lost boys to responsible men in South Sudan.
Joseph Akolmakir came here in 2003 with four younger siblings, all orphans.
A woman from Fargo, North Dakota reflects on the current unrest in South Sudan and the people she's worked with and helped for nearly a decade. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Chesterbrook Academy Private Preschools and Elementary Schools in the Delaware Valley supports WHYY. Chesterbrook Academy offers students a personalized, well-rounded education. Open houses will be held Saturday, January 25th. Learn more at chesterbrooktoday.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about some of the hottest and coolest gadgets from the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. And again, Joanna Stern and Mark Purton are guests. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. We also have an email from Beck. I'm interested in these wearable technological gadgets, but I'm concerned about data mining by corporations and protecting my privacy. Can your guests comment on this? Joanna, we were talking about some of these wearable devices. Is that a concern, do you think, out there in the hinterlands?
Yeah, I think that's a concern with any new technology that debuts. I think we had similar questions and uncertainty when smartphones really went mainstream. I think we are going to have similar concerns with wearable technology. I think especially with Google Glass, we're seeing the privacy concerns is that it has gotten a lot more press and it has become more, you know, more prevalent on the heads of people. The idea that you're not really sure if people are taking a photo of you, that's definitely a legitimate privacy concern. There, it doesn't appear to most people that there's an indicator that someone could be taking a photo or video of you, and that is troubling to many people. I think Google is going to have to address that concern in the next version of Glass, and I think Google will have to address that with more and more talk about what is going to be the social norms around this, and then I think there has to be some sort of regulation around it all. So it is definitely a concern, but again, in the early days of this.
What do you think, Mark?
Well, I agree, and I think your caller or writer specifically mentioned things like data mining.
Right.
And I think for any kind of technology where you are sort of uploading data to a third party, you have to make sure you understand exactly what the privacy policies in terms of service are and always be aware of when changes are made to those. We've seen that across all of the social media services where if people are not sort of on top of what the privacy policies in terms of service are, you can potentially be subject to policies that allow your data to be shared in ways that are unexpected. And a lot of the wearable products out there now are things like fitness and activity trackers. And a number of them are companies that are encouraging you to share data via their websites and share data socially. And in some cases, the thing that consumers definitely need to be aware of is making sure they understand exactly what privacy policies are in place, what terms of services are in place before they share that kind of data.
Let me ask a couple more questions. Are you seeing drones and drone technology on the floors at CES, Joanna?
We are. I mean, I only have really focused on some of the consumer robotic drone technology. Mark might be able to speak to if there's been any sort of debut of other type of drone technology here, but a company called Parrot has been showing off some of their newest, I wouldn't call them toys, I think that they could have some other really interesting use cases, but they are in a way sort of remote-controlled drones that you can use your phone to pop them up in the air and use them for different things. And they had a drone that they debuted a couple of years ago at CES, and that really, I think, brought the idea of drones mainstream, people seeing that, I can control this thing with a smartphone, and then people use them, people and companies use them in interesting ways.
Mark, do you see drones that Amazon could use to deliver packages to our house?
I don't think we're quite there yet. I agree with Joanna. We certainly have been following Parrot and some of the other companies that are on the floor, and definitely it's a technology that everybody is intrigued by and is a lot of fun to watch. I don't think we're quite there yet. I think Amazon has done a great job of sort of building buzz about the idea of drone deliveries, but I still think we're a ways away from that.
Is there anything, Mark, that just has blown you away at CES?
There are a number of things that I'm really excited about here. I think that some of the sort of advances in things like virtual reality and head-mounted displays have really come a long way. We had a couple of finalists in Best of CES in that category. There's a small startup called Avagance that has a head-mounted display that uses essentially a virtual retinal display. It literally projects images directly onto your retina.
Whoa.
And that might sound painful, but
yeah.
It's actually perfectly safe, and it's the kind of thing that I think we're going to see a lot more of. Another company, Oculus VR, has the second generation prototype of their head-mounted virtual reality gaming device, and it's light years ahead of what they had even just a couple of months ago. So I think there's some really intriguing advances happening with that technology that we're really starting to see potentially reach consumers very soon.
But are we talking about gamers as of today, Mark?
We are, but not just gamers. Avagance has been showing their display as something you can use for immersive video in terms of watching movies and really seeing a virtual 80-inch screen right in front of your face. That sort of technology has been explored for a while. Sony has had a number of products in the marketplace that do that sort of thing for years. But we're finally starting to see the technology actually work better. Companies are investing in things to limit sort of the kind of motion blur and things that sometimes made these things uncomfortable for certain people to use. Mm-hmm. Whether it becomes a mainstream screen technology or not, it's something that is starting to really come of age and actually be more practical than it's ever been in the past.
Yeah, how do you see it, Joanna, virtual reality gadgets?
Yeah, I put some of these on here as well, as I was saying earlier in the show, and it is the type of thing where it's a different type of technology. I think we've gotten so used to the sort of flat, not a very immersive experience that we're getting from our smartphones or tablets. And when you put these things on, you really can't believe how far things have come, right? I mean, I think 3D, even when people put on a 3D pair of glasses now in a movie theater, it definitely gets all the senses going. And when you put these things on, I mean, it's hard to describe how immersive it is and where you kind of could go with putting these on. And I'm not a gamer, and I'm really intrigued by it. When I put them on, I'm just kind of turning my head around and I'm in another galaxy or I'm in some sort of a jungle. And that's interesting.
Yeah, great escape. We have an email from Rich. I was impressed to hear about how the Wii device is used to make rehabilitation exercises more interesting and fun. And I guess the idea of health and gaming put together, Joanna.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that's where some of these companies that are gaming-first companies do see the extension going. And I think we are seeing a really interesting theme across a lot of these companies to push into health and wellness, whether that be by wearing something on your body, whether that be by tracking information in your body, maybe that be about doing different stretches, as this person's describing, about rehabilitation in some way. So it is certainly one of the next big trends in this industry as people think, all the companies think about health and wellness.
And that's Joanna Stern, personal technology columnist for the Wall Street Journal, joins us along with Mark Parton, executive editor at Engadget, and they are both at CES, the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, and telling us about some of the interesting new technologies and new gadgets that they are seeing on display at CES. You can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, as our other listeners have done, at radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coane. Mark, I'm wondering about driverless cars and other car technologies that might be at CES. Can you get us up to speed on that?
Yeah, absolutely. We're definitely seeing more in that direction, and a number of companies have been demonstrating what is possible with that. BMW is here, and some of the others, and I think that clearly driverless cars are the kind of thing that everybody's excited about. We're not going to get flying cars anytime soon, so maybe driverless cars are the next best thing.
Yeah.
It's going to be quite a while before they are at the level where not only are they considered safe and reliable enough, but where there's a regulatory framework in place that consumers and the government are comfortable with. A couple of our people, went for test drives in BMW's car and thought it was great, but it's definitely not something you're going to see on highways anytime soon. But a lot of the sort of same concepts and technology used for driverless cars is already sort of trickling into things that the manufacturers are doing to make cars safer and better. BMW showed off a number of active features that will help cars in terms of avoiding accidents and parking and just sort of making a lot of the routine decisions that drivers make more, basically providing assistive technology so that drivers have the car helping them respond on the fly to things that could present dangers in the roadway, as well as helping them with things like parallel parking, which, you know, I'm looking forward to because I'm absolutely awful at it.
It's not easy to do if you don't do it a lot. And Joanna, I mean,
I'm with you there.
Yeah, go ahead. And I'm thinking of cameras and sensors, the things that newer cars have that help navigate and I think deal with some of these safety issues.
Yeah, I mean, some cars, of course, have some of this already built in. To what Mark was saying, I find it really interesting, the idea of helping to prevent accidents and the idea that these cars can kind of be an assistant or be your eyes on the road as well. I think that's what a lot of these kind of companies are talking about, is you're still in the car and you're really the pilot and the car can help you. Well, it was interesting yesterday, I'm forgetting the name of the company that's showing this sort of the car is driving by itself, and if you step on into the road right in front of it, it will stop.
Wow!
And one of my editors thought that would be a good idea to have me step in front of the car. I was not offended. I was like, sure, it's only my second week on the job. I'll step in front of this car,
and
I did. And I'm walking, and I'm here this morning. So you know, it took a couple of seconds for it to stop. So I gave it a little bit of time. But it stopped on its own, and then I walked out of the road, and then it resumed going. So certainly this company is not planning to put this on the road anytime soon, and Mark had touched on, obviously, laws and issues standing in the way of this going mainstream. But it's fun stuff, and it's very interesting.
Well, since no one stops at stop signs and goes through red lights, I would be all in favor of that new technology. Let me get to Bernie from East Kensington to join our conversation. Bernie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm surprised with all this virtual reality stuff and flying cars. And why can't we have cell phones that sound good and have like caller ID with name? I mean, these are like really basic technologies that have been around for decades. Why can't we have them on our cell phones?
Well, Bernie, it's such a great question because we struggle with phones here on Radio Times more often than I care to think. And Joanna, do you want to take that first?
Sure. Obviously, me having problems calling in today. Yeah, I think the interesting thing about your question is that my big thing is a lot of people, I wonder how many are still talking on the phone, right? Mm-hmm. As these companies have beefed up their networks, they're much more laser focused on the data speeds and the speeds of getting messages across and video calling across. And it's certainly a really great point you bring up about audio quality and the idea that Can we actually make phone calls? And T-Mobile's been here at the show. They've been talking about how they're really committed to improving their network this year. Again, not really focusing on the audio calls, but definitely focusing on the speed of the phones and the speed of getting their network up across the country in to really rival AT&T.
Mark makes
I don't know, Mark might have a better answer to why our audio calls aren't.
Yeah, because I'm getting kind of nostalgic for landlines. But go ahead, Mark.
Well, I mean, you know, the fact is, you are continuing to be at the mercy of things, you know, like cell towers that, you know, are may not be optimally placed and, you know, quite honestly, at the mercy of just things like, ambient background noise, which, you know, as you move to smaller and smaller devices with, smaller mics and, not necessarily, you know, calling from sort of an optimum location are going to affect things. I think, you know, when you're the sounds are for landlines, you're thinking of the sort of giant handsets with a big cup-like, mouthpiece, and then those did do a good job, and the wired networks definitely were more reliable. I think that there has been progress. If you look at sort of a lot of the recent advances, you see phones like, some of the new ones, certainly the iPhone 5S and some of the others, where you'll have multiple mics built into the phone and noise-canceling technology that essentially works to sort of erase background and ambient noise to improve voice quality. And some of the headsets that are available now do a lot of the same things. that obviously doesn't necessarily address the network issues, which as you know, more and more people are using cell phones, and you know, now more people with cell phones than landlines, inevitably the networks become more congested. And you know, as Joanna said, if the manufacturers and carriers are focusing almost exclusively on data, that's not a priority for them.
Well, and Joanna, we're almost out of time here, but what do you do for when you have downtime at CES?
That's an oxymoron, because there's usually very little downtime at CES. But that might just be for me. I think journalists have a different view of the show. We want to cover almost every single thing we see here. But some of my colleagues did have some downtime last night, and they went to go see Fleetwood Mac. They were playing here. So all of these companies, just to give people a view of how this happens, I mentioned the Best Buy. It's sort of like Best Buy during the day, and then at night, sort of a music festival, because you've got Las Vegas here. You've got that set, you know, in contrast to all of this technology. And so people throw, all these companies throw massive parties and hire lots of talent and celebrities to show up. So that's what I think most people do on their downtime.
Mark, is that what you do?
Well, I'd have to concur with Joanna. I think that's what other people do.
Okay.
The idea of downtime in CES is not something that I personally experienced. I'll have downtime maybe on the plane on the way home, although thanks to flight Wi-Fi, I probably won't really have any downtime there either.
Well, on that note, Mark Burton, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And you're welcome. Executive editor at Engadget. And Joanna Stern, thank you very much for joining us as well.
It was a pleasure. Sorry about the cell phone connectivity.
Well, we're working on that. But no, I appreciate
you. We will be pressing the carriers to work on that.
Exactly. And she's personal technology columnist for the Wall Street Journal. To continue this conversation on CES or the Philadelphia schools or sea level rise, go to WHYY.org/radiotimes. Leave a comment. Also, check us out on Facebook, Twitter, podcasts. Check out the archives. Get information about satellite radio and send us an email, WHYY.org/radiotimes. Bob Ball's the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.